Today we are hosting a special guest, Professor Michel Danino. So welcome to our studio.
Thank you. Good morning.
Today's visit of Orville will continue to our lecture in the afternoon at 5 p.m. at Pavilion of Tibetan Culture. So what the lecture is going to be about?
I selected a topic which has been close to my heart for quite so many years, and it's, let us say, the relevance or use of ancient Indian culture, civilization, for today's situations. My approach is very simple. If there is no possible application of concepts, explorations, researches that were evolved in ancient India, then of course it would mean that the culture is virtually dead. Mm-hmm. Or it would be maintained simply as a kind of decoration. So I've been exposed to, through my travels through India, I've been exposed to many scholars and ordinary people, and I've seen that actually that culture is still alive in many ways. So those ways is what I will try to convey this evening, but also the certain little explored developments of ancient India that could still be very much applicable and not directly applicable, but adaptable to present situations that could still help India today.
An announcement is written in between that the ancient India culture is present more merely like artistic decoration, although in some villages it's still present somehow. Do you have any idea why it's like that?
Problem that many colonized nations have had to face. This process of decolonization and trying to make sense of that hybrid culture which was created by colonization has been a very complex one in India, because the amount of external interference has been enormous, and as we all know, you cannot go back to the past. It doesn't make sense and it doesn't work. It's not even possible. So therefore, what do you do? You have to move forward, but looking back and still keeping certain roots intact, of roots into what is really timeless in that ancient culture or ancient civilization. That which is not timeless, let us say customs, traditions, that will go. That has gone to a large extent.
It
has
disappeared to a large extent. Living entity. Yeah,
but certain things are more essential, more central, and those are among those that Sri Aurobindo pointed out in his writings on Indian culture. Those still have applicability. That's what I would like to try and bring out, if possible.
Mm-hmm. Since you mentioned Sri Aurobindo, you've been in Orville in the beginning of your life in India, right? For 5 years,
I heard. Yes. When I came to India in 1977, it was to Orville that I came, and yes, I was here for 5 years.
And you also translated many writings of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother.
Especially most of Mother's Agenda from French into English.
I have a personal question, if you can answer. Why did you leave?
It was almost incidental. It was not, inwardly I didn't really leave. Mm-hmm. It was simply a matter of organization for this work, which you've referred to, and there was an institution coming up in the Nilgiris, with which I was associated for a long time, where Saprem and Sujata were actually, coordinating this work. And this work had to be done in a certain concentrated way, which was not really feasible
from
here.
Orville itself, yeah.
So it was more, I didn't have a feeling of leaving, really. It was more that, circumstances of the work led me there and led me elsewhere later on. And, you just follow the circumstances.
And you end up in Nilgiris, and you were also passionate about afforestation, yeah?
Yeah, while in the Nilgiris, I was quite active with the Tamil Nadu Forest Department in protecting a very special type of native tropical forest, evergreen forest, the so-called Shola forests of the Western Ghats. And that was a 20-year-long experience and work, and very rewarding in some respects, very frustrating in other respects. But I learned a lot. We were able to save that forest after all. It's still standing. But I learned a lot about, you know, how things sometimes do not work in India, sometimes can work in India. And, you know, Westerners coming to India, of course, come with a whole mindset and ways of doing things. And many times they just don't work. You have to do things differently here. So this has been a learning experience for me, and well, for those I worked with, I think it was also a learning experience from other angles. So it was quite interesting. And I'm still, to some extent, when in my current place of residence near Coimbatore, I'm still involved with the forest department in a less intense way. There are huge problems of, you know, elephant human conflicts and things like that, and I keep interacting.
I can imagine it's a huge work still. I mean, it's ongoing thing. But however, you are more passionate about history and archaeology, yeah?
Yes.
You published a book about the lost river Saraswati in 2010.
Yes, this has been an old love of mine. Even before coming to India, I was, though it was not the kind of studies that I followed, which were more on the scientific side, but I was always interested in the history of ancient civilizations. And of course, in India, you have a unique situation where the most ancient civilization still has some connections with the current culture. So I did pursue fairly in-depth study for quite some years, and I've been lucky to interact with great scholars in India, a few abroad, but mostly in India. And yes, I studied certain issues. I still have some books coming out, hopefully before long, on these issues of ancient Indian culture and history.
The talk we're going to hear today is also from the book, right?
Not as yet.
Not yet?
It might turn out to be a book one day, and maybe I'll take a cue from your suggestion. Well, there is a book on Indian culture and India's future, you're right. Indian culture and India's future, where I started touching on these topics, but I haven't really made a thorough development of it, and perhaps I should once certain ideas mature a little more. Let us see.
When the seed is ready, it will, will start sprouting.
Sure.
And the theory of Aryan race, that it's recolonized, or actually that it's indigenous?
The topic
was kind of controversial.
You know, much of misconception on this Aryan issue that it's very difficult to summarize, but that's actually the book I'm presently working on for many years, in fact. It's quite a massive book, which I hope will come out next year. And my conclusion is that this Aryan construct is really a construct. We have imagined an Aryan race, of course, that was demolished long ago, though it persists in Indian textbooks. But at least sound scholars from whichever perspective are aware that there was never an Aryan race. So that's not the question. But the question was whether there were an Aryan entity, whichever way you define it, and usually now it's defined linguistically, that ever entered India. And I think my conclusion is going to be that this also is to a large extent the product of our imagination. So I'll be traveling a long journey through the origins of Indian civilization and showing that it's a hypothesis that we do not require, that no evidence actually demands. So we keep, and I'm not the first or the only one to have said that. There have been many scholars, even recently in France, one prominent archaeologist argued that this is just the lingering construct from the 19th century, now perhaps shorn of its racial connotation, but nevertheless we keep being deeply influenced by this notion that there was an Aryan something. And in fact, if you read the Rig Veda, there is no Aryan something. There is no Aryan people. There is no Aryan ethnic group. Whenever the Rig Veda speaks of ethnic groups, it uses totally different names. So anyway, I think I will not start developing all the arguments, because it's a very, what shall I say, frustrating as well as rewarding, again, experience, you know, to deal with these issues, because you have to really go very deep to sap the foundations of certain half-ruined constructions.
I was wondering, because I know that it's more and more evident that a lot of history is actually biased. Mm. It was written by the ruling, let's say, whatever it was, nation or mm-hmm. sometimes race or whatever it is. So many books actually have to be rewritten and to search. I think you're facing a lot of challenges, no, and obstacles.
Yes, of course. Well, I'm not the only one. Again, it's been part of the process of decolonization, not just in India.
It's everywhere.
You know, those who were colonized, exploited, dominated, didn't have a say in their own history and now should have. But in India, things got a little complicated because different schools of history developed. Problem is that though a lot have survived from the past, a lot have also disappeared. And there's been a huge amount of destruction in Indian history. So we are in any case dealing with very, very limited material. So therefore, honest historians know that, and therefore they know that they can only hope to reconstruct a small, you know, portion of what would have been the reality. But you have other historians who have their own bias and who are very confident, you know, that they can give you a true picture, but that actually is not. You know, the American historian in the 1930s, Will Durant, once wrote that most of history is guessing and the rest is prejudice. Yeah. It doesn't leave much scope for an unbiased history. In fact, there's no such thing as unbiased history. By definition, it will be biased because you have a modern mind and you try to read the past through that modern mind. So therefore, you're whether you want it or not, you're automatically projecting your models, your construct, your... But there's, of course, an honest way of doing it, and there is an ideologically influenced way of doing it. That's where the whole conflict arises.
It's actually super interesting, no?
History was mythologized.
But it's a part of... It is history still, no? I mean, it's...
Well it's very hard to... Well, but you have to separate the grain from the chaff.
Yeah,
so how do you do that? And this has been also discussed extensively by many scholars. So some are very dismissive. They'll, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, it's all fiction, it's all myth, and let's therefore just forget about it. But of course, those myths do cover some historical kernel. Extracting the kernel is a very delicate exercise, and you're never really sure at the end of the day.
Yeah,
but there is some scope here and there. I tried as far as the Saraswati River was concerned. I thought there was a good case for extracting the kernel without too much damage, so I don't know. I just gave it a shot.
I will read the book because I read the description. It sounds really interesting, and it really take you somewhere and another thought, okay? I mean, there have been many, you know, the planet itself is a living thing.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the humanity itself is evolving and living things.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many options, possibilities. What really happened like a million years ago, like
yes.
In this case, 5,000 years ago, yeah? It's something, as you said, from the modern, I perceive a might, but that's not really maybe the case, yeah?
Well, it's if you go to the textual sources, then you have a lot of difficulty because of this mingling of fact and mythology, which ancient Indians, you know, enjoyed constructing. But there are other types of evidences which are far more objective, like archaeological evidences, scientific evidences. Now genetics is coming in, sometimes archaeoastronomy, anthropology. Paleo-environments, now you cannot do today archaeology without studying the ancient environments. So ecological factors are now understood to have played enormous roles in the rise and fall of cultures, material cultures. So all this is well understood, and actually there's a rapid accumulation of this kind of objective data. But even then, even though you may have scientific data, you may have very objective, you know, materials that you have dug up from a site. Even then, when you start interpreting, you're still using certain biases. And there a lot of caution still has to be. And that's why you have archaeologists disagreeing over the same excavated material. You have geneticists disagreeing over the same kind of genetic studies of ancient populations and so on. It's not easy. Even in science, you have a lot of space for disagreement. So honest disagreement is fine, and you have to.
But I think like ultimate truth probably does not exist. We can just put
exactly
light on it from different corners. Yeah,
that's right.
In the middle, we might
and accumulate the data. The more data you get, the less at least you can rule out certain things.
And now you're by the time, since your visit is short, and I still want to take you somewhere. You are working in IIT Gandhigarh University.
IIT Gandhinagar, yes.
And you,
in Gujarat.
You recently, in January, you were awarded with Padma Shri.
Padma Shri.
I was curious, what is that?
Government of India every year gives this honorific title to a certain number of individuals who are assumed to have, or estimated to have, contributed something significant in their discipline, whether it is science, medicine, education, culture, whatever. So I was extremely surprised because I didn't feel that my contribution was very significant, and I know a lot of people, scholars, educationists, and so on, who have certainly done much more than I did. But anyway, I had to take it as, with much gratitude as the kind of recognition that India gave to my whatever little contribution I could give. It's actually an obligation of me to do much more. At the end of the day, that's what it does.
But as a foreigner to receive that, I think is quite an honor. Right?
I am not a foreigner. I'm technically an Indian citizen.
I
took Indian citizenship quite some years back. But I'm foreign born. But Indian government has regularly given such recognitions and awards to foreign scholars, especially Indologists. So there's nothing very, very abnormal about that.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Miriam.
See you this afternoon. And
with pleasure.
Probably next visit when the books will be out.
Let's hope. Yeah, looking. Okay.